Interview with Mr. A.D. Price from Corpus Christi. Mr. Price, at the present, is retired. He worked 26 years for CPNL. He went to Embalming School in Chicago. He has a college degree. He taught school for some years. He talks about, mostly about the past, all the way to the present. Mr. Price is very well traveled, very well read, intelligent, and very experienced with some of the problems of the black people. In his interview, he mentions discrimination. He mentions stories about the old days, and he talks about a hanging in Waco and a lynching in Cameron, Texas. From what I gathered, Mr. Price is very interested in the young black people, not only the young black people, but in young people in general.
I'm fine, and I've retired, and so I'm taking it easy now.
Where do you come from, and when were you born? Can you tell us something about yourself, please?
I came from Atlanta Junction, Texas, about 12 miles and a half east of Cameron, Texas, which was the county seat. Cameron was the largest city in the county, and that's where I was headquarters for shopping. After I left and moved to Milana Junction proper, after my primary years, but then I entered school. And I entered school, and we didn't go any farther than the seventh grade, but I did go to a private teacher, and they taught me through the eighth and ninth. Then I left home, went to Temple, Texas, stayed there with my brother for 2 or 3 months. Then I left Temple and went to Waco. That's where I entered school, and that's where I attended college. I entered there in the 11th grade, finished the 11th and 12th grade at Paul Quinn Academic School. Then after that, well, I took up my college work there. Went to school 1 year. Then I went to Chicago to take up embalming. And I decided it was too cold in Chicago, so I came back to Texas. I entered school again at Waco because I was a singer. And I sang and traveled with the choral club over about 4 different states. And I made most of my schooling, paid for most of my schooling through my singing. Then I got me a high school certificate, 2-year course certificate to teach. Well, I started doing sub work for teachers when they would be off. After that, well, I got a job out at Clifton, Texas. And I had one teacher school there, but I went through the ninth grade. And of course, I got a better job embalming, which I had finished in 27. And after I got this other job, well, I resigned this school at Clifton. But I didn't stay with the embalming job because it wasn't paying enough money. Then I got a school teaching out at Cotton's Inn, Texas, 6 miles east of Mahare, Texas. And I stayed there for 14 years. And the people liked me very much, and I enjoyed working with them. And the kids were very obedient, and I had very good discipline. And I wanted to stay there, but I decided to go into undertaking business. And I quit the school and went to open up an undertaking business in Waco, Texas, of which for 2 years it was very successful. But because of matrimonial troubles, I left Waco and sold out everything. I came to Corpus Christi from Waco in 39. And then from that, I've been here ever since. I worked for CPNL for 26 years. Retired with them. After that, I started doing sub-work in the city of Corpus Christi, which brought old memories back to me of my young days of teaching, which was very pleasant. But because of my health and the conduct around the school among the students, I quit work there. So from that on, I haven't done anything but just sit here at home, tried to make home happy for my wife and I. We lived and traveled around over the United States, viewing different places that I wanted to visit when I was young. And I went out to Chicago and visited the ancient spots out there. And I also went to Florida and did a lot of visiting there around Miami, Florida, and Palm Beach, Florida, and Pensacola, Florida. And there was a large naval base there at Pensacola, Florida, and I visited the naval base with some of the Navy, colored black Navy boys, and I enjoyed that trip very much. But since that time, I've just been here in Corpus, living and trying to make life happy in my old age. Yeah. Of course, we have had such a sudden change in the society of our people, black people, until I don't associate with them very much because of their militant attitude. I don't believe in militant. I believe in equal rights, social rights, and whatnot, for color, for black, but not to take it. I don't believe in trying to force my way in anything that where I'm not wanted. I get along fine with all of my church people. I belong to the AME Church, Brooks Chapel. And Reverend Brown is our present pastor. We got along fine. We have erected a very nice church. And I'm the secretary of the church and have been for about 15 years. And it works me plenty. I get enough exercise doing the church work. But we have up at our church reorganized it in a way that we have so much help in the clerkship work. I don't have to do all the work by myself like I used to. And my wife works along with me in the church, and we get along fine with all of the members up there. Of course, I have been working with the Masonic Lodge, which I was the deputy of five counties, and I was the worship master of the local lodge. So we had a membership of 115 with our lodge when I was a wishful master, but I resigned it because of my health. I had a light heart attack in 1967, but it didn't permanently injure me, but it made my life somewhat different, because when you have a heart attack, you've got to learn to try to live with it, or else you'll go soon. So I've taught school around here in Corpus with the city. I got along well with the superintendent and also the, I think his name was Mr.
Hesley.
And he was very nice to me, and he enjoyed talking with me whenever we would meet. But I wasn't there, around there very often, because when I wouldn't be teaching, I'd be here at home trying to get up on some of the studies of what we were using in the schools here. Of course, the books are so much different from what the books used to be. They made so many changes until you have to kind of keep up to be successful. Well, a lot of the kids, I spoke some Spanish because I had 2 years in Spanish in college. But not using it, well, quite naturally left me. Some of the children would want me to teach them elementary Spanish, but I wouldn't go into that because I hadn't been authorized. So I worked at the elementary school and also the high school and the junior high school. And it was a little hard to jump from one to the other because the material you had to use was so much different in it. And you had to have a good memory to recall the elementary work that you had pertaining to the high school work. So So after all, well, I was very happy to be in the system because that was really my calling. I feel it was. When I was in elementary and high school, I was always an A and B student in those grades. I didn't have any trouble with my teachers, and all the teachers seemed to think I had high hopes of trying to get up in the world, of which I wanted to be, but I didn't succeed after I dropped off and went into the undertaking business, and it wasn't successful. Well, then I had to drop back to the next thing of trying to make a livelihood. So we feel that we did fine because I had to school myself. All of the money I used in my schooling, I made it myself. I worked at night most of the time and went to school in the daytime, which was very hard on the body, physically and mentally, because you have to have a certain amount of rest for both of them, of which I didn't get when I was in my young days of going to college.
How were the racial feelings while you were going to school, both high school and in college at the time?
Well, the racial feeling was very quiet in a way, because the minority group just had to do what the higher group demanded. And we didn't have no affiliation or association with them at all. And we had a hard time, but I managed to look over it and go around it and go where they wanted me to go. There was no way I could demand any better treatment.
Did you experience any direct discrimination towards you? And can you give us an example if you did?
Towards
the black people?
Oh, yeah. In all cases, we weren't allowed to vote. And when we go in a store, we had to just be meek and humble. We couldn't say, I don't want that, I want this. And things like that was very hard. But I was here in Corpus Christi, one incident that happened. I was the executive secretary of the Black Chamber of Commerce. And there's a store here at the time that a colored person couldn't get credit. Well, I had near A number one credit rating. And I went to them and I wanted to get my wife some dresses there. They turned me down. Well, happened they had turned down two other colored women, and we got to talking. So I went down and talked to the manager about it, and I asked him why. Well, he couldn't give me any definite reason why. He said, we just don't give credit to colored people. And I asked him why. He never did give me any reason why. He seemed to think within my mind that they weren't stable enough, truthful enough to pay the bill. But that is one of the hardest things I had faced. And of course, while I was working at Central Power Light Company, I asked for a higher job, an advancement. In other words, handling the mail. Well, they told me, my boss told me, that there wasn't anything there for a Negro to do but janitor work. When I was doing all the mail, I did the mail there for them for 2 years, after doing World War II when they couldn't get anybody to work. Well, I had to teach all young white boys that come there, teach them how to run the mail room and how to divide the mail and deliver it, because it was a full-time job, but they wouldn't give it to me. I stayed there, though, because of the fact that I was planning on staying there until I retired, because that were some fringe benefits that anyone could appreciate. So I stayed with them. I tried to work in with the White Chamber of Commerce in a way to help us to bring peace and stability to the Negro Chamber of Commerce. Well, I talked to the president at that time, of Mr. Bell, and I got an appointment with him, and he told me, come on up, and I went on up there. And when he saw I was a Negro, he said, well, now you got to hurry up. I ain't got time to sit around here and fool around all day. I said, well, if that's your attitude, I said, I'll go ahead back, because I'm not here to hurry. but I'm here to talk business with you, for you to help us to bring up the short ends of Chamber of Commerce work among the Negro. I said, we're not a political organization. I said, we don't attempt to be. And we're not going to try to run any blocks. We're not going to try to go above our limits. I said, but yet and still, you could be nice enough to give me some ideas of how things should go since I was the executive secretary. Well, he said, well, go ahead and talk about what you want to talk about, but I'm in a hurry. I said, well, I'll just go. Goodbye. Mm-hmm. So I walked on out and left Mr. Bell. Mm-hmm. It was very funny to me after I got away. I said, now, you see, that's the way they do you. And, of course, that wasn't fair. It was like when I was teaching school in Freestone County. Well, the superintendent down there, I had a three-teacher school, and 85 registered students. Well, the white school had 70 registered students. They had three teachers. So I wanted to know why the black school, the Negro school, couldn't get the same accommodation given through the state as the white school. He said, well, you're Negro, that's the reason you can't get it, you just can't have it. Well, that was a joke. I hated it for the simple reason I was successful in the community. But I would take my boys in the upper grades out. And we'd go around the community doing work around people's houses, repairing, putting on window screens, putting in doors, things like that. So we had a good time, and I was successful in bringing the boys up in a manner that they would have intelligence enough to start out on their own. Because that's what schools should do, is give us student thing that he can use in his afterlife. After he finishes his schoolwork, he'll have something to go home. Like when I was attending Prairie View College, well, one of the boys in my class, they put him on program to make an address there one night. So he was talking about the agriculture department, and he told the right before the teacher, he said, everything I've got to go for naught when I get out on the field. He said, I can't use any of this. He said, you teachers in school have got to learn what the people out yonder need and give that to us so when we go back there, we'll be prepared for it. So we always had to learn what we were to do when we got communities because they didn't give it to us in the colleges. Of course, they were raided. They were Class A raided. And especially Prairie View, because it's a state school and it was rated with the Southern Association of Colleges and Universities. But we were held back. It throwed us off base in all our work because we didn't have the proper equipment in all cases to do our work, especially our laboratory work. And we did good, made good, but it was short of what life really called for at that time. So that is the gist of our schoolwork. And now concerning our church is all Negro church. There's no whites connected with it, with the exception of those few that have joined since segregation has been declared. For the simple reason, if anyone want to join our church now, they can join. But all our executive heads are Negroes. And I've stayed with it and been with it ever since I was a baby. Because I was baptized in the AME church. This AME church, it is all over the United States and in two countries in Africa, which they are divided, you know. And we have bishops over there that come over here, and we also have them in Haiti and in India. And I was a delegate to the General Conference on several occasions, and I met many Latin Americans that are in the AME church, but there's not any around here as I know of. And we have what is known as our setup. It is a democratic on a democratic basis, which was picked up from the federal government. Works just like the federal government. We have a head president as the president of the United States. He's the president of the AME Church. But he has a group of 18 bishops on his board as his directors and helpers. And they do, each one is assigned a different thing to do and to work out and bring in problems for the General Church. General Church is located in Washington, D.C. And we have what is called the 10th Episcopal District. So many states or so many members are in each district. And we have a bishop that's over our district, the 10th Episcopal District. He lives in Waco, but he is an appointed bishop. And when we have our annual conference, well, the bishop's always the head of the annual conference. And he's just called them all together just like the teachers do. The state superintendent called all state teachers associations, and they are governed by the state, just like the AME Church is governed by what the bishop said and his board of directors. We cover all of the United States, and the membership is the largest in the north and east. They have large memberships up there. But down here, the Baptists are far ahead of the AME Church. But that doesn't matter, because our church was organized by a Negro man because of one fact that the white United Methodist Church, they call it now, wouldn't accept us. They accepted us and then they rejected us, because in Philadelphia, where we were organized, the AME Church, well, the United Methodists pulled the members, black members, up off of their knees at prayer one Sunday and told them to get out. They weren't supposed to pray there. They're just supposed to come there and listen. So they went out. And they organized an AME church in a blacksmith shop. And that's how the AME church got started in the United States.
Mr. Price, again, thinking back when you were young and you were going to school, were there at any time, at any given time, were there any blacks trying to get into politics at all?
No, they didn't allow us, in my days, they didn't allow us to vote or anything, but they'd come around and talk with us and see how we were feeling about this, about that. There was nothing specific that we had to do or could do. Mm-hmm. We couldn't vote or anything. Now, some Negroes were big landowners. They would let go out and pick them out and let them slip in and vote. But the average person couldn't vote. If they were big landowners, they could vote. If they had money, they could vote. But we had it very rough, and of course, many minority groups in this United States were about the same shape. I remember the time when they didn't allow Latin Americans, which were classed and rated as whites. They didn't allow them to go into white dances. They didn't want them to stay in the hotels. But finally, it eased on down to that. I remember one year when I first came to Corpus, they almost had a riot down here at the New Aces Hotel, because the Latin Americans wanted to go to a big social dance or something down there that night, and they didn't want them to go. So they liked to have a riot here that night, because the whites had that superiority complex, and it seemed to think they had it in their mind that wasn't anyone good enough to come out and associate with them. But after the 1954 law on segregation was passed, they lightened up. I've seen the time when I had to go to the back door of any cafe to get me a sandwich or to get me something to eat. I remember the same thing with Latin Americans up in North Texas when they first started coming up there. They were that way with the Latin Americans. They wouldn't give them any chance. And they were like the Negro. They had to take the menial job. They couldn't get any job that they could do. Well, my known knowledge of the Latin Americans that were drifting into the United States at that time, they were very good mechanics. That is, construction work. They were very good at brick masonry, iron work. But they couldn't get a job in North Texas doing that because they were a foreigner. Right. The white man got that job because it paid more. But the Latin Americans and the Negro couldn't do that. We had to do railroad work and plowing, chopping cotton, such as that, menial labor.
Can you give us a description of how the schools were when you were young, again back to elementary school, and maybe the stores and the banks?
Well, the schools that I attended, we always didn't have anything that we needed but old secondhand books. We never did get any new books unless we were buying them. Now, at one time during my life, we had to buy our books. Well, we got new books then. But after the state decided that we weren't supposed to buy books, well, then we only got new books. Very few maps and very few chemicals to work with. We didn't have no laboratory. And all the science we would just teach it from the paper. But we couldn't go through with any experiments or anything. And in a very few of the schools, well, a lot of the schools, they didn't have real desks and benches like they have in nowadays. We had to sit down on homemade benches like they make, 5 or 6 people sitting on a bench. And we had to write in our laps. Well, that is the greatest difference that we had in those days. Then they fool around, they would take the old seats out of the white school and put them in the Negro school. We never did get any new seats, never did, as long as I was in elementary school and high school. And I didn't know what the benches were unless I would go to the white school and see them in the room until I got to Paul Quinn. That's where I first got to use the desk that was for school purposes and one student desk. But the school were very ill-equipped. We didn't have anything hardly, but just the books, as I said. And we didn't have any maps. We didn't have any, globes. Didn't have any of our geography work. We just had to teach the children the best we could.
Where did you do most of your shopping, grocery shopping, and so on down the line?
Well, grocery shopping, we did fairly well on it, although in that day you open up account, you would never hardly get out of debt because the grocery wouldn't let you get out of debt. Mm-hmm. Don't care how much you'd pay him, you were always behind. Mm-hmm. I remember when my father was farming. Well, we had a big farm, inasmuch as there were four children in the family, but we had 2 both boys that my father adopted. So that made it 6 of us in the family, 6 children. Well, we had always planted from 75 to 100 acres of cotton and corn, peas. And we never would get out of debt. Don't care how many bales of cotton we made. Sometimes we'd make as high as 52 bales of cotton. That's the highest we ever made. But we didn't get out of debt. We were still behind when we sold all our cotton. In those days, cotton was at such a low price, you would get 5 to 7 cents on a pound. And it wasn't very much. You get 13, 15, maybe $20 for seeds out of a 500-pound bale of cotton. Well, you wouldn't get, including your seeds and your cotton, you wouldn't get hardly $100 for a bale of cotton. So it was very hard, and whenever we had a chance, we'd go out and do menial labor, cutting wood for people, bringing in wood, hauling wood for people, applying for people and things like that to try to make our ends meet. We weren't able to go and buy many clothes. If we got a suit a year, we were on top because we didn't have the money. Although my father did feed his family good of what we ate. Of course, we raised our own meat. We never did hardly have to buy any of that. Sometimes it would give out, but most of the time we'd have our own cured meat, and we'd have our own beef. We'd kill beef and can them. The women would do the canning, you know, put them in jars and in cans, and we lived very good as far as our grocery shopping was done. And I remember one time I went to a store to get a suit of clothes, and the man didn't want me to try the suit of clothes on. He called himself measuring me and giving me the custom-made clothes by his measurement. Well, I wouldn't take it that way, so he told me, that's what I say about these black niggas. They come in here and want to try on these clothes, and they know white people got to put them on.
Yeah.
Well, that was a slap in the face, you know, in the dry goods store. But my mother and father, they did most of it, the shopping, as long as I was with them. And after I was away from them, well, I was on my own.
Can you tell us something about your mother and father? More or less, when were they born and when they died? And do you recall any stories they told you at all?
Yeah, my mother would sometimes talk about how hard it was and how they punched them around, you know, when they'd go out to work. Hurry up, do this, do that. And my mother was close to me. I wasn't very close to my father. My father, I had two brothers older than I was, and he was closer to them than he was to me. Because I left home when I was 15 years old because he was a little too rough for me. When I got up what I've called a man, I wasn't a man at age, but I was a man in size. Mm-hmm. And I weighed more then than I did now. But he was very hard on us. On me and my sister, we were the two that are left behind. And that's the main reason I left home. So I don't know any many of the tales. He just always talked about what we were going to get into, and you better be careful about the white people because they would rock us and chunk us, and sometimes jump on you if they see you. You'd be walking along the street, sometimes some would come along and just curse you and turn around and ask you, did you like it, and all of that kind of thing. Well, those are some of the things we had to contend with. We had no law behind us. And if you would speak back to a white man, he called it sassing him. Well, we didn't call it sassing him because we called it trying to protect ourselves. But we know we didn't have anything that we could go on to protect ourselves as far as fighting was concerned, because we didn't have the guns and the ammunition. We may have had a gun, but we didn't have over half a dozen shells or cartridges in our house. It was hard for colored people to buy guns in those days. They said, you don't need a gun, you need a shotgun so you can kill rabbits and squirrels. Well, we had those, but rifles and things like that, it was hard. And I have a rifle now of my father, that 3220. It's old. Much older than I am, and that's the only gun that we had that was stable we could use, you know, in case of attack. But it was very, very hard during those days.
Do you feel like it was harder as your parents grew, or was it just as hard as you were growing?
It was hardest when I was growing up because there were so many things I didn't see why I couldn't do this when that one over there could do it. This boy here is a white boy. He'd come up and he'd chunk people and walk along the store and pick him up an apple and eat it and keep a walking. But the Negro couldn't do that. If a Negro would do it, the white man in the store may catch you doing it. He'd come out there and knock you down or slap you and then make you pay for what it was. Mm-hmm. He'd hold you until your parents come to pay for this article. They were terrible in those days. But that was when I was coming up. After I got up, I learned not to do those things. And if I saw anything I wanted, I'd go and ask him for it. And if he wouldn't give it to me, I'd do without it. But I never was hard up after I finished college. I always had money and a good way to go. I just saved what little money I would make, and finally I built up me what we call a nest egg. And I didn't care. And if I was sad in one of them, I'd be willing to walk off the job because I know I'd find another job, same kind of work. Couldn't get anything better, but I could find a job the same kind of work. So those are the things that come most vivid in my mind as of today. Mm-hmm. Of course, there, during the intervals of things, different things happened. Like when I went to Chicago to go to school, to embalming school, I stayed in a hotel up there that where colored and whites roomed there. White girls, white men, colored men. We roomed in the same building.
What year was that?
That is in 1919. I went to Chicago to, I'd finished my high school work, you see. And I went to Chicago to take up embalming because I was working for an undertaker in Waco. And I wanted to learn it, so I went to Chicago. They had the best embalming school in the United States at that time. That was Worsham School of Embalming. And I went up there to go to school, but I did register, but I didn't stay. It was too cold. It got cold up there in September, and ice, snow, freezing. Couldn't hardly walk. You see, I wasn't used to that kind of weather. Of course, down here in Texas, we have ice and snow sometimes, but most of the time you stay in the house until it thaws out and you can get around and get about your work.
Mr. President, there still was a lot of discrimination in 1919.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it kind of surprised me that you said that.
But it wasn't so much in Chicago at that time. And I was in Kansas City, Kansas, in the same year, in 1919. Well, there I went to several what they call, they didn't call them clubs at that time. What is the name of that they call it? Cabarets. If you had the money, you could go. But you had to be particular and not overdo the chance that they gave you. So we did go to cabarets there, and in Chicago we did stay in the same building. And that was in 1919, right after World War I. See, I didn't go to World War I because I wasn't old enough. And things loosened up during World War I, if you remember. Well, you don't hardly remember because you're not old enough. But things loosened up during World War I for the Negroes. They had a little better chance because the NAACP, which is a colored organization now, I'm sure you've read of it, had started to work back in those days of trying to make things better for the Negroes. And it started back, I don't know exactly when it started, but it started in the teens. And we had certain leading Negroes at that time that had made a success in their life, and they were recognized by the whites. And that is W.D. Du Bois and the college over here at First Negro College.
Not Prairie View.
No, it's in Alabama, I think it is. Tuskegee, Alabama. And that school over there was about the first that was organized as a college for Negroes. And they made a good head start because they were well liked because of what they were doing for their race. And the white people encouraged them and encouraged the race to associate and go to their school. But in Texas, we never did have any rail-rated colleges until in the 1900s.
Why don't we take a short break, and I'll change the tape, and we'll continue for a little while. Do you have time?
Okay, yeah.
Do you recall any
World War I stories?
Well, the greatest story that I recall is a boy that was a sergeant in the Army. He was stationed in France. And he told me a story of he was going with a French girl, and there was a white lieutenant going with this same girl. And the white lieutenant asked the girl, why did she want to be running around with Negroes? Said he didn't like it. And he told her that in the States, that's what they called it, in the States that white and blacks don't mix, but there was very good association seemed to be in France. And he told me that this lieutenant told him he better not catch about that. Well, then he went to his commanding officer, and his commanding officer turned around and told him, said, well, he think that you shouldn't go with her because you don't do it in the States. Well, in the States, when those boys got back here, they tried to get equal rights, tried to get better living conditions, but they couldn't do it. They were still driven backwards. And then another incident, one of the boys was telling me that when he landed in New York with his company and regiment, they were segregated in those days in the Army. But when they landed, well, didn't anyone hardly show up to greet them home, and they didn't like it. Then when they got out of the Army, and some of them before they got out of the Army, they would try to do as they wanted to do. But there was lots of strife and struggle. And during World War I, they had a riot in Waco. I was living there at the time. The 24th Infantry, maybe you have heard of it. It may be in history. I doubt it, though. I have never seen it in history. But the Negroes, soldiers stationed there, they broke into the building where they kept all the guns and ammunition. And they came back fixing to shoot up Waco. But somehow or another, the commanding officers quieted them down. But several people did get hurt. And then they moved them from Waco to Houston, Texas. And that's where they had the riot. And there's a lot of those boys were sent to the workhouse and to the penitentiary on account of that riot. Now, I had one close friend that I was running with. He was older than I was, but I was running with him. He and I got along pretty good together, and we were running together, and mainly because I was a college boy and he wasn't, and he was living in town, but we were very friendly. And he was in that riot in Houston, and a lot of people got killed out in Houston, Texas, when they had the riot.
But what year was that? Do you recall more or less what year it was?
That must have been along about 20, because they sent them right on to France right after that riot. They took all those that weren't accused that was in the regiment and replaced them with boys that hadn't been in the riot, and sent them on to France. That in the year of 1918. Mm-hmm. And that is just before the armistice was signed later. They were over there about a year. But they, in Houston, tore up Houston on San Felipe Street. I never will forget it, because I used to go to Houston all the time. And quite naturally, so many of those people were talking about how sad it was and how scary it was, because they didn't have any other army there to face those Negro boys. They didn't have anything but the police department there at that time. And so they couldn't do anything with them, but they did finally get them corralled. But there were several colored boys got killed, and a lot of white people got killed down in Houston, Texas.
What was the attitude of the law towards the black people then?
Oh, it is worse than it. Oh, it is bad. It is bad. Anything that anyone would come up and say a Negro did it, you better own it whether you did it or not. They'd beat you. When they arrest you and carry you to jail, they go get you in jail and beat you until you said you did it. Now, that used to happen all the time. That is the main reason the NAACP got busy working, trying to get better living conditions. And that is one of the reasons why you hear so many, many Negroes say today that the white people get them in jail and put them under arrest and then want to beat up on them. And we've had lots of cases like that, and which was bad and is bad today.
Do you recall any incidents whereby someone was picked up and taken to jail and accused of a crime?
Well, there's a colored boy in Waco. He was picked up, said he raped a white girl. He was picked up and hung immediately, drugged down the streets behind an automobile on at the end of a rope. Now, that happened in Waco.
What year was that, more or less?
That was in 1916 or 17. Don't exactly remember the date, but it's just back in those times. And this boy was finally, after it was all over, the girl let it leak out that the Negro didn't rape her. It was a white man she was going with. But she didn't like the Negroes, I guess. Papa or something happened that they caught up with her. Then she accused the Negro of raping her. And then they caught this Negro and lynched him. That was at the end of the rope. And the same thing happened in Cameron, Texas. Now, in Cameron, Texas, I was a young kid then. I was about 7 or 8 years old. But when they lynched that Negro in Cameron, Texas, well, they went all around the streets in Cameron telling all the Negroes to get off the streets, go home, get out of town. And we left town, too. We ran our mules and horses to our buggies and wagons just as fast as we could drive, getting out of town. Then that evening, they hung that Negro and then burned him. And after they hung him, well, he was hanging up there on the tree limb, then they just riddled his body with shots, guns. And then they took him and hauled a lot of lumber and kindling and stuff there and made a big bonfire and throwed him in that fire, burned him up. That was in Cameron, Texas. That is one reason I left from Cameron, Texas. Didn't go back there anymore unless I'd have to, because of where they buried that Negro. I can remember the spot and everything. It was bad, because they had a great big tree there in the courthouse yard. They hung him to that tree. And that was supposed to be on the federal land. And how could the federal government stand for a person to be burned at stake? I didn't see it. Of course, I was very small, but as I was saying, during my early years in school, I was very smart to my book learning. And those are the things that has been hard on the Negro. And now, since they have given us the chance, I think these Negroes nowadays should be more lenient with trying to take what they want, because they can get what they want through law. I don't think it's right for them to try to take it through strength and force, but through law, because the law covers these things now, and you haven't got anything to do, but when you are mistreated or abused, you haven't got anything to do but go and file charges. And like they make them put everybody, different groups on the jury will give them a chance. That's the way I look at it. Of course, a person guilty, well, he's just guilty if he's found guilty.
Do you feel like there has been a great progress done towards the black people?
There's been much progress done. There's been very much. I remember the time in Waco there, they accused a Latin American. He couldn't speak any English, hardly, just a few words. They claimed that he had stole some stuff there from the place where he worked. They put him in jail, kept him in jail nearly a year before he could get out. He didn't have any people there, and there were very few Latin Americans there. Well, I happen to know that because I traded at this garage where he was working. And of course, quite naturally, the colored boy there told me of all about, you know, the condition. And his boss man wouldn't go up there and try to get him out because he accused him of stealing. Well, it turned out to be somebody else stealing.
Yeah.
But yet and still, they punished this poor Latin American fellow because he is what they call a wet bag.
Mm-hmm.
And they found out that he wasn't in the United States legally, but he had been here for a lot of years, several years, because he was older than I was. So those are the things that we all think about. I don't like to think about them now and don't like talking about them, but they're true. One time I was arrested in Cameron, Texas, for killing a man in Amarillo, and I'd never been to Amarillo in my life. And I was young, and so they carried me across the streets to the courthouse. They didn't do anything to me, though, but we sat down and talked, and I told them who my parents were and where I was from, Milano. Milano, Texas, down here, just 12 miles. Well, when were you out in Amarillo? I said, I've never been out there. I said, I've never been out in West Texas at all, no place. I said, I've been right here in Milano Junction, Cameron, Texas, Waco, Texas, and Houston, Texas, Galveston, Texas, all my life. Those are the only towns I've been in at that time. But after they turned me loose, and I told them who my father was, my father was well known there in Cameron. Well, I guess they talked with the man where I told him we should did all our shopping, his Heffley brothers. They talked with them, and the Heffley told him, said, no, Jim Price and his kids, either one wouldn't do anything. No, let that Negro alone. So they let me alone on account of Heffley brothers. But I went on around the street, and another deputy stopped me. I said, I know what you want. I said, I'm not who you're looking for. I said, they just had me around at the courthouse. I talked up to them.
Mm-hmm.
I said, they just had me around at the courthouse trying to prove that I killed somebody in Amarillo. How'd you know about it? I said, they told me. All right, you better be careful. We're watching you. Well, things like that was hard. They just picked you up because they see you. It wasn't because you had done anything that they knew of. But they seemed to think that all Negroes were the same, which they weren't.
What is your opinion of the Black Panthers? Are you familiar with them?
I don't believe in them. I don't believe in them at all. Now, their motive may be good, but their actions are bad. That's just the same thing I'm talking about now. I was talking about a few minutes ago. What's the need of going trying to take it faster than it's coming? Well, that's all the Black Panthers are. They're too militant. I believe in their first motive was to try to get equal rights and justice for Negroes. But they've gone too far. They're militant in as much as they are more forward than they should be. They cause a lot of trouble. If I'm in the way and someone said, will you move over and let me by? Well, those Black Panthers, they may tell you quick, they ain't gonna move. I got a right to stay in here as long as I want to. Well, maybe you do have the right, but the other fella has a right to pass. See, I shouldn't prohibit or stand in your way, but I should move to the side and let you pass on by. See, that's the way I look at life. Now, there's a, just like this, Masonic Lodge. Well, when they first passed that law that the ending of segregation, well, several whites have wanted to affiliate with us. And they have in some parts of Texas. They have affiliated with it. But they didn't want to go out and open wide in Fort Worth and our Grand Lodge. See, I was a Grand Lodge officer. Well, I got up in refuted the statement and told him, I said, we can't do that now. I said, we'd be going backwards if we try. And I said, furthermore, the person that you segregate, the white person that you segregate from our lodge today can sue you for discrimination. Then they saw the light and then they opened the doors. So now the doors are open. Well, I had several meetings in the valley when I was deputy, I had several meetings down there and invited those Spanish Masons to come to our meeting. They got so they'd let us meet in their hall. They have beautiful halls down there. And they let us meet in their hall, and they'd come to our meeting, sit up there. We'd give initiations, and they would have lots of fun out of it. Well, I call that breaking down segregation. I think we ought to all be one. Now, the book that I studied in Masonry are the same books that they use. Now, it says free and accepting Masons. So, I use the same book they use. They get them from Cook's Publishing Company, or either from this other big company in New York. They get their books from there. That's where we get our book from. The books are the same. We read the same material. Well, why segregate us?
Briefly now, what is your opinion of the black people in Corpus? Has there been progress, too, since you've been here?
Oh, yes. There's been a lot of progress since I've been here. Well, now, when I came here, there weren't over 39,000 people, white, Mexicans, and blacks, in Corpus Christi. And now it's over 250,000.
When did you get here? What year?
39. Mm-hmm. And right here, well, now, we've got black people now working in the bank. We've got black people working in the post office. We've got black people working in the stores, clerks, salesmen. And we've got black people that are selling white insurance. When white insurance companies used to let a black man be an agent for them. But that has come to pass right here. Well, now, my agent at the Tennessee was black for a while, but he's not now. He quit. I don't know what the inside was, but he finally quit. But he kept for about a year. And then another colored boy come along, and he had the same debit, and he was my agent. But he moved to El Paso. They sent him to El Paso. That's why he left. So if they hadn't sent him to El Paso, maybe it'd have been my agent still. But things like that are the things that make you know things have improved since the year of 39. But in 39, 40, 41, 42, 43, in all the 40s, it's hard here for Negroes. We weren't allowed to do anything. We couldn't feel free. And in just certain places we were allowed to go. Now the first place that I went and was able to get a seat and sit down mixed with the white people were in Del Mar College. They had a big program down there one night and a concert. And they were just selling tickets. Well, I was able to get a 2.5 ticket. And now, me and my company, we were able to sit in mixed up with the whites. Now, that's why I know this progress is made.
What about World War II? What about the Negroes, the Negroes' role in World War II?
Well, the Negro agreed and discussed it that they would go to war. They would fight for the United States. But when they come back, they wanted equal rights. And it finally worked up to that, but it didn't soon. Now, Roosevelt had things under his hand at that time. In other words, he was a czar. Roosevelt could have declared desegregation in all fields at that time when he was living during his lifetime, but he didn't do it. But his wife was preaching it every day, everywhere she'd go. She would make speeches all over the United States. Give all human equal rights, equal justice. But I don't know whether there's a difference in her and her husband or whether he had her doing it that way. He was afraid that the white people would go against him. If he had declared it, he had the power. But when the Negro got back here, that is what started this militant business. The Black Panthers were organized back long in there, right after World War II. Of course, they were talked of before that, during World War II, but they weren't doing anything. But a lot of the black people, which I don't think is right, they listened to the Africans coming in here, trying to tell them what they ought to do. Well, why they didn't do that same thing in Africa? Why they want to come over here and start it over here? That's what's caused a lot of people to start thinking like they're thinking and trying to be so militant and so forward in their life. But that isn't any good, because the Negroes, they come from Africa, the Negroes come from Haiti, the Negroes come from the Virgin Islands and islands like that. They come over here. Why did they come over here? Because they couldn't do nothing in their own country. Why did they want to come over here and start? Because there's a lot of blacks here. And by them getting in a crowd of blacks, they think they can persuade the black to raise up. Well, the Negro study one thing. In the Bible, there's a portion of the Bible that says the black races will rise up. See, black people were the first real leaders of the old world. Now, I don't know how much of that you study, because you only get that through religious study. Mm-hmm. But they were. The blacks were the leading race at one time. Well, it was taken away from them. Well, it's because of when they finally come down to it, is when during slavery time, when they started to transport Negroes and selling Negroes and bringing them to the United States. See, the United States has come in with the Negroes that they would bring from Africa. And when they got them over here, they had to pay for those Negroes coming, transportation and so forth, coming over here. So they said, this is my Negro. He got to do this. He got to do what I say do. He can't go anyplace. He can't go to town and get what he wants. He got to tell me when he's going to town. Well, that is why the militancy started in this country, is because the Negroes coming from these foreign countries.
Again, locally, Mr. Price, do you feel like there is enough black leadership here in Corpus, or do you lack?
We lack leadership. Now, why I say that is because of the fact we are not up to the point, regardless of what anybody say, we are not up to the point as yet of having natural born leaders. We all want to be leaders. See, all right, for instance, when I was a deputy grand marshal, deputy grand master of five counties, well, so many of the boys, they wanted to be deputy grand master. Some of them even talked to the grand master about electing him for the grand master of this district, which we call the Corpus Christi district, because this is the headquarters. Well, in every walk of life, in every organization that we start, everybody want to be the leader of that organization. That's why we're fighting each other. In other words, you can take the black race, they are more like a bunch of crabs in a tub. When one starts climbing up the side of the tub trying to get out, the others will pull him down. Mm-hmm. And that's the way we are. I've even had people here in Corpus Christi, in other words, Sampson, used to be the principal of Moore High School. Cold High School. Moore High School is Waco. Well, I came here, I didn't have my degree in college, but I had a permanent certificate to teach. Well, he wouldn't give me a chance to teach here. He wouldn't hire me. Wouldn't let me be hired. Even much Mrs. Butt, H.E. Butt's wife, went to the city board and talk to them about me, trying to get them to give me a job. I had been in several conversations with her, and she knew I was not a graduate, but she knew I was rather intelligent. So she wanted to know why they wouldn't give me a job. Well, at first they said they weren't hiring people that were not graduates of a college. Then when they whipped that down, then they said they weren't hiring people that weren't special in a special certain field, you know. You got to be the history major, psychology major, science major, English major. Well, that kept me out. Well, Sampson had heard of me, and he knew of me in Waco. Of course, he lived at Temple. He was principal school at Temple. And he wouldn't give me a half a chance. Not a half a chance. Well, if he had then, well, I'd have put in most of my time that I spent in Corpus Christi in the schoolroom. Because that was in 1941. See, I started working for Central Power and Light Company in 1941, and that's when I met Miss Butt. Well, she did go to the bat for me, but she couldn't get me over.
Mr. Price, if you were talking to a group of young black students right now, what would you recommend to them to succeed in life?
To succeed in life? My idea of succeeding in life is go to school, get your good, an education as you can get, and be special in whatever you're doing. In other words, try to be the best of whatever you're doing. Now, of course, it calls for a lot of hard study, but yet and still, that's the only way you're going to get over and keep that man from turning you down, because you don't know his mind. He's your interviewer, and when he interviews you, if you can't come up with some very, very intelligent work or answers, then he's not going to accept you. Right. And if you're in filling out an application blank, you have got to fill those questionnaires out intelligently. And if we don't know how to do that, then that's where we lose.
Right. Mr. Price, I enjoyed talking to you. I want to thank you for inviting me to your house.
Thank you.
And I'll be seeing you probably again.
Sure.
Thank you.
Well, I hope that this will be a help to your work.
I'm sure it will.
I hope it will.